This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Danny DeVito, first became known to audiences for his role on Taxi as the often exasperated, always misanthropic dispatcher, Louie.
What's the matter with her?
You wouldn't understand, Louie. Some people just feel sad at Christmas.
Oh, yeah? You think I don't know that? I got feelings.
Really?
My mother's that way. Cries every Christmas on account of my little brother Nicky never comes to see her. I'll give you the same advice I give my mom when she cries. I say, Ma, shut up.
After Taxi, DeVito's acting career took off. He's also directed films like Hoffa, War of the Roses, and the, as far as we're concerned, underappreciated comedy Death to Smoochie, about a children's TV host played by Ed Norton. Here's Norton, dressed in his big pink rhino suit, singing to the kids on the show.
He slams the door, he stomps his feet, sends me to bed with zilch to eat. But my stepdad's not mean, he's just adjusting. His temper's bad and he's a slob, he's bitter cause he lost his job. But my stepdad's not mean, he's just adjusting. So three.
Danny DeVito has also helped other directors get their films made. Among his many producer credits are Aaron Brockovich and the classic Pulp Fiction, starring Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta.
But you know what the funniest thing about Europe is?
What?
It's the little differences. I mean, they got the same shit over there that they got here, but it's just there, it's a little different.
Example.
All right, well, you can walk into a movie theater in Amsterdam and buy a beer. And I don't mean just like a little paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer. And in Paris, you can buy a beer in McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
I mean, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what the a quarter pounder is.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Well, Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
In keeping with the diverse choices that have marked DeVito's career, he's also starred in family comedies. In his new film, Deck the Halls, he plays a father and husband who's overzealous with the Christmas lights on his house, and that's aggravating his neighbor, played by Matthew Broderick.
I'm not going to stop until I have the biggest and brightest light display in the world.
Oh, please.
I really want my house to be seen from space.
Danny DeVito, welcome to Fresh Air.
Terry, it's so great to be here.
You know, I have to say, one of the things I find so interesting about you is that, you know, on the one hand, like, you know, you really became famous through Taxi, a hit TV series. You've been in a lot of hit mainstream movies and then family films like Deck the Halls. At the same time, you produced Pulp Fiction. You directed Hoffa with a script by David Mamet. I like that you're full of surprises and that you have really wide-ranging taste.
I do. I feel that I love doing what I'm doing. I saw in the late 60s, a film by Pontecorvo, which was called The Battle of Algiers. It was at Thalia uptown in New York, and I was studying acting, and I just didn't understand what was going on there, you know, with all these people. There was no documentary footage, and it was all real, it was all staged, and I wondered what a director did. And then as soon as I started studying, finding out what that was about, I have eclectic tastes. I like comedy. I like dark comedy. I like, you know, slapstick. I was a fan of the Marx Brothers and the Three Stooges and Jerry Lewis and all that stuff. But I also liked, you know, Rebecca, and I liked things that Hitchcock did and stuff that was a little bit more noir in the Edward G. Robinson area, and you know, Fritz Lang got into my life. And so there were so many different things that I loved. I just think going into the movie theater and having that light go down and you disappearing into that place, that other place, was always the thing. So I just applied it to my work. I say, you know, when an Aaron Brockovich comes along, I think it's a really worthy story to tell, and I'll do anything I can to make it to the, get it to the screen. So, and then apply my, you know, whatever style I have acquired from stealing from the best, you know, going, you know, you just watch other people's movies and you go, boy, I'd like to do that thing, or I'd like to do this. And then you start imagining those things yourself, and you apply them to all different kinds of genres.
Did you know that because you love movies, it meant that you wanted to act? Did you make that connection at all?
I always thought that I could do it. I didn't have the guts to go, you know, I look the way I look, and I was not the leading man type. I mean, I wasn't going to go out and come down the steps and all the girls would turn their heads and I would immediately go in and dance with anybody at the prom that I wanted. You know, those movies were all being done. You know, it was the Rock Hudsons and the, you know, Cary Grants and the all the leading men. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's who you like. But I did say, well, I could do that Peter Lorre part, you know, or I could... That Edward G. Robinson guy is, like, really tough, and that James Cagney guy is tough. You know, those are things that might... But I only had that way, 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 way deep, deep, deep in my mind. I never said that to anybody. And identified with people like that. And although I did want to get on that horse and ride off into the sunset, that would be yeah. cool, too, you know.
You know, listening to you talk... I'm thinking that Danny DeVito, when he acts in movies, often has a very kind of big New York or New Jersey accent, which you don't have, or at least not nearly to that extent, just speaking as yourself. Who had the greatest accents in your neighborhood when you were growing up?
I think my mother was born in New Jersey, so I have this like kind of New Jersey a little bit of like, it's not Baltimore, it's not like Philadelphia, it's not like, it's a New Jersey accent, and it's a little bit, I always thought it was a little Southern, you know, it was a kind of like a weird, well, I'm from, not South Jersey, but the idea is, my father was born in Brooklyn. So my father had the, you know, 33rd and 3rd, he would say, you know, like, where were you? I was on Troy Avenue, and it was a car conductor. I took the tickets. And then my mother's was a little bit more gentle, and it was from New Jersey. The whole family's from Italy, but they settled in different places. And my mother's accent was a little bit different. And then all the people in New Jersey had varied, but had a lot of influences from the New York area because of my cousins and my uncles and my aunts, and they would come down, and I always wanted to live in New York.
Do you feel like you do your father's accent in some roles?
I think I do, yeah. I do my father's accent, and it's a blend between, like, if you look at Louie, my mother was on the show. She was on
twice, Taxi?
On Taxi. Yeah, she played, there was a scene where Louie leaves his mother in a home, and then goes and gets her because he can't take it. And my mother was my size and gray hair, and she was never acted before in her life. And she was in her, I guess she was in her late 70s when we did that show. And she's walking down the hallway, and I say, and we're going away from the camera, and I go, Ma, she's holding her suitcase. I say, Ma, that's your bad hand. And I grabbed a suitcase, and I put it in her other hand. You know, so...
That's really funny, yeah.
I mean, it's in character, but, you know, it was something that, you know, you get from... You find that, you know, from... So if you look at that show, and also there was one show where we married her off to a Japanese man, which was hysterical, that Louis, you know, his prejudices came out. He didn't want her to marry a Japanese guy, and it was really funny. But we wound up having a Shinto ceremony and marrying her.
Well, you know, your character on Taxi and a lot of the other characters you've played over the years, including your character in the new film Deck the Halls, are they're very extroverted.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah, and are you as extroverted as that? You're not sounding as extroverted as that.
No, I'm not. I'm not extroverted. I'm extroverted in that I know what I want and I get it. I go after it. I do everything I can to, if I want to make a movie or direct a movie or act in a movie or start a company or do a thing or whatever, I go after it full force, you know. I'm not belligerent about it. I'm not like offensive about it, because I always feel like, you know, everybody's got their own thing going and you have to respect that. And that's the way it is in life, and that's the way it should be. You shouldn't be, you know, sitting back waiting for things to happen. You have to be aggressive in that way. Go out and go after things, and because it's exciting. It's the hunt. It's going after some dream or some idea. But you shouldn't be. I would say stay on the side of like being human.
Well, one of the things I believe you went after was Pulp Fiction, which you produced. Why did you want to produce the movie?
Because a woman who was working for me gave me a script called Reservoir Dogs. I was in the middle of, I think, preparing Hoffa at the time, and I had a deal at Columbia TriStar, and it was a deal that, as many thought, was a vanity deal, which means that you're only going to do movies that you want to be in or direct or whatever. But I literally, after War of the Roses, I wanted to embrace other filmmakers and try to make it as comfortable for them to get their work on the screen as possible, because it is a difficult thing to do, get your work on the screen the way you want it. And I read this script and I thought it was just genius, really wonderful, and I said, can I meet this guy? And I heard that the movie had already been shot, Reservoir Dogs, and I said, I don't care if it's possible, if he's in town, I'd like to have a 5-minute meeting with him. Just get me together with him somehow. And I did. I got together with Quentin. He came to see me, and I just listened to him for like 10 minutes, listened to his stuff. I said, well, what I feel is I can't be involved in this movie because it's already done, but whatever you're going to do next, this is how strongly I responded to him. Please let me be involved.
What made you respond so strongly both to Tarantino and also to the screenplay for Reservoir Dogs?
I think it was the passion that he exhibits and his confidence and his assuredness of what he wants, no matter what. And I think it's like a feeling that if there's any way that you can help that person get it through. I didn't know the situation he was in. I didn't know how many people knew him, how many people wanted to be with him. All I knew is that I wanted to be with him. I knew that it would be so much fun to make a movie with a guy like this who has this incredible talent that I read on the page, and then this enthusiasm that is brimming and wonderful. And he's young. He was young, a young guy, and I like that. I like to see people come out of like school or a video store or a college or a candy store or anywhere who have this verve, this kind of like special spark that people exhibit when they really want something in a good way.
So when he gave you the script for Pulp Fiction, did you think, oh, this is
well,
it, this is great?
I didn't get it right away. I made a deal with him. I made a deal with him that I would get his next script. He told me it was a series of stories that intertwined. He hadn't formulated it yet, and I said, fine. And we made a deal for me to have first dibs on his script. And he went away for a year and publicized Reservoir Dogs. And I kept checking in, saying, where's the script? And finally, one day, a year later, I got a script at my house, and it was 155 pages. It was hot off the press. It said Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino, final draft. So I sat down immediately in my bedroom and read it, and I was just totally laughing my head off and going crazy. And I said to Rhea, I said, if, you know, either this is a really funny, incredibly unique movie, or I am one of the sickest people on the planet. So it turned out to be both.
Did you want a cameo in it?
I actually wanted a cameo. Well, I was busy. I wanted a... yeah, but, you know, I was doing something else. And like I said before, it's all about making that artist's work get into that viewfinder. And that's what it's all about. I did fight for John Travolta so that he could get John Travolta, because nobody at the time wanted John Travolta. I think the studio wanted Daniel Day-Lewis. And I said to
Wow,
him,
I find
know,
that really... I like Daniel Day-Lewis a lot. He seems so wrong.
I love him.
He seems
yeah,
so
I
wrong
know.
For the part.
I know, but he was hot at the time, and John wasn't. And that's the way a lot of the studios work. I mean, that's not the way a lot of them work. That's the way all of them work. I said, look, I made a promise to this guy that I was going to do everything to make his vision get up to the screen. So we did, you know, I just went to the mat for John, and it was brilliant, worked out great, and everything about the movie was just from the time he started all the way to the time we, to today. It's just a joy.
You know, this is going to lead in a roundabout way. Okay. One of the people in Pulp Fiction is Harvey Keitel. And since you were one of the stars of Taxi, I always wondered what you thought of Taxi Driver, which is like...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not that they're anything alike, but one's like this really dark vision of this like lonely, yeah, alienated taxi cab driver in New York. And the
gosh,
other is this kind of sitcom version of Taxi Life.
Well, you know, Taxi Driver was, I think it was, might have been the early 70s.
It was mid-70s.
Yeah, mid-70s. I think 72 was
I think it's 75.
The other one.
75,
and then
I think.
75 was the other one.
Yeah, it's Taxi Driver.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I loved it so much.
Did
I thought
you?
The style was, yeah, the first shot of the car coming through the steam and
mm-hmm,
the whole just alienated, like, and such a great, Paul Schrader's great...
screenplay.
Yeah, just of putting somebody in a tin box with all this excitement going on around him, and he's doing the dirty work of cleaning up after people, and he doesn't have a life, and he's, you know, how else can you think if you're in that? If you look at it now and you say, well, are there other people like that? Yeah, you know, there are people like that who are in a kind of a squalor, and there's life going on all around them, and they don't have a chance.
Right.
They don't have a fighting chance to get out at all. And you may want that belladonna. You may want that beautiful rose or that flower or that garden or that whatever outside of it, but it's not attainable. And it just was just, you know, one of the top, you know, favorite films. In terms of Harvey's character, how sleazy can you get? But, I mean, I love that, you know, and, you know, just you think, you know, God bless Jodie Foster's mother and father, whoever let her do the part, because it was just so, you know, horrifying and,
right,
and, you know, just...
So obviously you really love Taxi Driver and really
completely
comprehended
totally
what it was about.
It.
So is there anything, like when you do like the sitcom Taxi, is there anything
yeah,
that you felt you could draw on from Taxi Driver, even though they had nothing to do with each other except for the
well,
taxi?
Well, the only thing I did, Terry, was I, in my populating of my, you know, that little booth that I lived in?
Yes, of course.
In the Taxi, most of my time was spent there. I decorated it myself, and I sent as a fan a letter. I mean, not a letter, but yeah, a letter to, and a picture, to Marty Scorsese and to Robert De Niro, and I had them just sign it for me, for Louis. So I framed it and put it in my in my case, and I had other various paraphernalia, but that were collected from the streets of New York and things that I, you know, like a, you know, something that I thought might have been valuable, or a piece of a sign, or this or that. But I populated the booth with stuff, and one of the things was I don't remember if I had a ticket stub for the theater, but that was part of Louis's thing.
Well, you got into movies in a kind of roundabout way, judging from what I've read. Your sister had a hair salon. You worked mm-hmm. at the hair salon for a while mm-hmm. and decided you wanted to be a makeup artist, but apparently
right.
to get into the school in which you wanted to study makeup art, you had to do a monologue, and you
yes.
did a monologue and decided
yes.
to go into acting instead.
Well, you know, it's kind of like, you're going to have to finish your question.
Oh, I was wondering what monologue you did for the audition.
Oh, I know exactly what monologue I did. I did Tahini from the Tea House of the August Moon. If you remember, it was a play, and then it was a movie, and actually Marlon Brando did the movie. He played Tahini. The thing about that was, I was in Asbury. I was doing this work for my sister, and I really love her, and I appreciated everything she did for me. I was saving a little money, and then she said, why don't you do the makeup thing? And I went into New York, and I couldn't find it. And then I kind of stumbled on this place, this American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and they were the only people that taught the makeup thing. And I spoke to the woman, and she said, you'd have to enroll as an actor, because I can't really moonlight. I can't do anything outside of the... And I said, fine. So I went, and I went to the place. It was a night school situation, because I was working during the day in Asbury. So I went in, and I picked a bunch of monologues. I looked at the one I thought was the most fun, and I learned it. And I went in, and I auditioned, and they accepted me, and I paid attention to pretty much all the classes, but I especially took extra makeup classes. And then she let me sit in on a couple other ones. And then I got hooked. I remember when it happened. I think we were reading Mice and Men, and I was playing Curly, and the teacher was, like, amazing. He was just, I don't know, he gave something that was a little bit more than, I guess it was his passion, and he cared, and I do respond to that. And he just felt like he knew and what he wanted, and I immediately started, you know, reading the play from the beginning to the end over and over again until I finally said one day, I had this incredible thing happen to me where I said to my sister, you know, look, I love doing this, but I'm going to go to New York, and I'm going to enroll in the school, in the day school, and I'm going to become an actor. And it was like, you know, everybody was sitting there with their mouths open looking at me. My mother and father also, and everybody embraced it, and they said, you know, do what you feel is good for you.
You went to a Catholic boarding school, and I read that you,
mm-hmm.
you asked to be sent there. Why did you want to go?
Well, I was in Asbury, and I was in Asbury High for a couple of months, and there was a lot of stuff going on there. It was like, I want to have as much fun as the next person, but I felt like this was getting a little far out of my realm. There were a lot of damaging things going on at the school at the time in the area, and a lot of people doing a lot of things that you probably would regret. And so,
you're talking about drugs, violence?
Violence, robberies, this, that, and the other thing. Anything that was going on that was, that was easy to get into to make a few bucks. And I had a friend whose father was the one who started that getting out of town thing. And this friend of mine, I grew up with him, went from kindergarten all the way up. And he said he was going to this place out in Summit, New Jersey. And what you did was, it wasn't a you'd go out every week. You'd go on a Sunday night, and it wasn't that far, and you'd come back on a Friday, and you could spend. So it was kind of a great toss-up. You didn't have to really give up your friends, but you were away long enough to not get involved in anything that was too risky. I always felt I had a future for some reason. I always felt I could. And maybe it was the movies. Maybe it was me thinking somewhere deep down, you know, I could do that, what they're doing up there, but I'm never going to get to do it if I'm in Trenton State Prison. So I might as well, try something else. Maybe get out of town. Maybe, you know, do a little Holden Caulfield, you know, or something, or just, you know, move away, move away from it.
My guest is actor, director, and producer Danny DeVito. He first became famous for his role in the sitcom Taxi as the dispatcher, Louie. Before we get back to our interview, here's a scene with DeVito and Andy Kaufman, who played the mechanic, Lotka.
Louie?
Huh?
Louie? Listen, I have a bad cavity in my tooth. So is it okay if I leave early and go to the dentist?
Dentist.
Yeah.
That reminds me of a story I heard yesterday.
Yeah.
This guy goes into the dentist's office,
uh-huh.
And he says to the nurse, he says, "Nurse, me and my wife are having very bad sexual problems. So could I please make an appointment?"
Yeah.
So the nurse says, "Oh, sir, you don't need a dentist. You need a psychologist." And he said, no, nurse, I need a dentist. With my wife, it's like pulling teeth. Yeah, pulling teeth.
So then that means it's all right to go to the dentist?
No way. Okay, now get back to work, Locker.
Right.
Now, one of the people who you've worked with over the years was Andy Kaufman, and then in the movie Men on the Moon, you co-starred in the film, and the film was based on Andy Kaufman's life.
Yes.
With Jim Carrey playing Andy Kaufman.
Yes.
It must have been kind of bizarre in a way to be in a movie where Jim Carrey is playing a person who you actually knew very well and worked with for several years. But what I'm wondering is, do you get a sense that he really could kind of control the difference between him and his personas?
Yes, I had a great feeling for Andy. I felt that if you look at the genesis of it, it was a performance. And I saw him like in the very, very early days when he was just coming out on Saturday Night Live and doing the bongos and doing his kind of cool stuff. And so I read this article years ago. I think it might have been in the Village Voice or some other paper that I read in the 60s and 70s, and it was called We Are the Dog. And it was kind of, I don't know why this just popped into my head, Terry, but it was like, you know, when, you know, six or seven people are sitting around a tree and they're all getting loaded and a dog walks by, everybody kind of looks at the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And you just watch the dog for like 5 minutes while it walks around the tree. And it walks over and it does something or it comes over and sniffs. And then it leaves. And then you come back to the conversation. And Andy was like that dog. You know, you could not take your eyes off of him. He was like just walked into the situation and was the center of attention, a baby, something. Anything that just brings you, blows your mind. And I think he knew in the very beginning, he didn't know in the beginning. And then he started to play upon that and use that. And it was refreshing for everybody around him. For me, for all the people in the Taxi, we were always like, we always loved when Andy was in the show because we knew that week was going to be, there was going to be a lot of curveballs, a lot of things happening. Like he would be standing in the back of the thing and a woman would walk in, postal woman would walk in, and she'd have a package in her hand. She'd go, "Oh, this is a package for Danny DeVito. Is Danny DeVito around?" or such and such. And And they would go, oh, yeah, he's in that room. She'd knock on my door. She'd give me the package. I'd sign for it. And she'd be leaving, and he'd go, before she walked away, why aren't you in the kitchen doing dishes? Why are you taking this job away from some guy who needs it? And she'd go, what? You know, this is like not that far away from the 70s. This was like early 80s. And you go, she said, what? And she's not like a little, she's a postal worker. She's like, looks like, you know, she's formidable. She's big. She's got muscles. She's got like bigger than him. And he would pick a fight with her. And he'd say, well, if you think you're, you know, such strong and you could take over and all this stuff, take a man's job, let's wrestle right now. And he would wrestle with her right there in the hallway. He would incense that woman to the point of, this is a little bit off the beam of
No, this is fascinating. It's
how
fascinating.
He knows. But he would do that until the woman would get so mad at him. Now, I know that Andy doesn't mean that. I mean, he means it. He wants to fight with her. But I know that deep down inside, he's going like, you know, this is my art. This is what I do.
Right.
And they would get on the ground, and we would be all standing around, and they would wrestle. And sometimes it got close, really close. But most of the time, well, all the time pretty much, he would wind up pinning the woman. And it's just because Andy was not like a little guy. He was a moose.
Well, he used to challenge, you know, in his act, he would challenge people to wrestle, and then there was that whole thing where he actually got hurt. But you'd never say anything, right? You'd never intervene and explain to her, this is theater. This is
no.
really theater.
Well, we would always apologizing to Andy, and we'd go, yeah, that's the way he is. But you couldn't do it in front of him, because if he was there, he would go, what are you talking about?
Have you been thinking about him in watching Borat?
Yes. I did answer that question pretty fast. Yes, I do. I watch Ali G all the time, and I watch, you know, the Borat stuff. I've been a fan, and I went to see the movie, and I literally think of Andy all the time. I think mm-hmm. that there are very few people who stay in character like that, who can
right.
just commit to what they're doing in such a strong way. And,
but it must be frustrating as a friend to have somebody who commits to character so thoroughly that maybe it's hard to just have a regular interaction with him.
Yeah, it's not a, you don't look at, it's unfortunate, but I did feel close to Andy, but I never felt like, you know, he did come to my house and have dinner and stuff like that, but it was always his dinner, it's not like a, you know, people go, hey, you want to go see the new so-and-so movie? Let's go out and get a beer and then see the movie, or vice versa. See, it's not like that with Andy. It was never like that. It may have been like that with Bob Zmuda, with some people that hung out with him and his girlfriends and stuff, but it was never like that with the people at the show.
We only have about a minute left, and
I'm sorry.
I've really enjoyed talking with you. Now, you've talked about how much movies meant to you growing up, and the movie theaters that you'd go to in Asbury Park, where you grew up. I believe you have your own movie theater in your home now. So tell us how you designed the movie theater to give you what you want from the experience of watching movies, which you obviously love to do.
Well, I had a space that was in the back of, I built a part of a house in the back of the house. There was a space, and I needed a certain amount of feet because I wanted it to be sizable, so that it wouldn't be, because I wanted to show 35 millimeter films. You know, it's just it's a comfortable movie theater. I don't show movies as much as I used to because everything's moving so fast, and we have the DVDs and.
Mm-hmm.
So I still project them, the DVDs. I have a really nice DVD projector. But I, you know, there's nothing like watching them on celluloid.
Do you miss the experience of actually going to a movie theater outside?
I go all the time.
Do you really? And
I go every I go sometimes 3 or 4 times a week.
And people don't bother you when you go to the mall?
They say hello. They say hello. Hello. Hey, Danny, how you doing? Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I heard this was a good movie. Yeah, I'm going, blah, blah, blah. And we go to the movies. I get my popcorn. I go sit. I go every week.
That's great.
Because I wouldn't want to ever miss that. So I, you know, maybe I'll see you at the movie someday.
Yeah. Well, Danny DeVito, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Danny DeVito is starring in the new family comedy Deck the Halls. Last week, the lyricist Betty Comden died at the age of 89. She collaborated on lyrics with Adolph Green, who died in 2002. They wrote the lyrics for shows like On the Town, Wonderful Town, Peter Pan, and Bells Are Ringing. Here's Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra singing a famous Comden and Green song from the movie On the Town.
We've got one day here and not another minute. See the famous sights. We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it beneath the Broadway lights.
But we've hair on our chests, so what we like the best of the nights.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
Famous places to visit are so many, so the guidebooks say. I told my grandpa I wouldn't miss on any. We got just one day, gotta see the whole town, right from Yonkers on down to the bay. In just one day.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
Women are all in silk and satin, so the fellas say. There's just one thing necessary in Manhattan when you got just one day. Gotta pick up a date, maybe seven or eight on your way in just one day.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York.